Larry Watson has been crafting fiction for decades. His first novel, In a Dark Time, was published in 1980, but the second was rather slow to follow 13 years later after winning the Milkweed National Fiction Prize. That bestseller became significant in many ways.
When I wrote Montana 1948 and set it in that corner of Montana, I didn't know that I would write other books set in that part of the world. But that book opened a vein for me. And I don't mean vein like veins and arteries, but, you know, like a vein of ore or something that I've been mining pretty steadily ever since.
Larry Watson returns to the Montana setting with his 10th novel, As Good as Gone, a High Plains Book Award finalist and longlisted for the 2017 Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction. We'll hear him read from that novel and his essay from the publisher Algonquin Books about why cowboys, real and imagined, are important in our culture and in his work. He also shares some of his approaches to writing in this 2016 talk for Rainy Day Books at Mid-Continent Public Library's Woodneath Center. So stay with us for New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and here's Larry Watson, who's been living and teaching in Wisconsin for decades, to give insight into the more Western settings of his novels.
I'm not from Montana. I grew up in North Dakota, Western North Dakota and eastern Montana are very similar in their landscape and their population. And by population, I mean there isn't any, so you're free to put people there. I have been writing about that part of the country and about that part of the 20th century a lot. In fact, a reviewer said that this was another book set in, I'm not sure if he said Watsonland or Watsonia or something like that. As Good as Gone, the title wasn't my title. I think of the books that I have published, only once was my title on the final version. I'm a terrible titler. My working title for this was Cowboy in the Basement. Somebody at the publishing house didn't like it. They felt it had sort of comic tones. As Good as Gone is a phrase that appears towards the end of the book, and it certainly says something about Calvin Sidey. Calvin Sidey has left Gladstone, his hometown, he's left his family, and he's done that on more than one occasion. Somebody observes about him, he's a man who's just ready to go. I think it's true of other men of that era. So I thought, sure, that applies to him. This is my first book published by Algonquin, and it's been a really terrific experience. Before the book was published, Algonquin asked me if I would write an essay saying something about the background to the novel, something about perhaps the inspiration. I'm not sure I believe in inspiration. Maybe I do. There are days I do and days I don't. And at first I thought, oh no, it's an assignment. I don't want to do this. But, you know, I don't like it when my students don't do their assignments. So I buckled down and got to it. And one of the things that occurred to me was that some things from my childhood found their way into this book in different forms. So for example, when I was a boy, I loved Western movies. And of course, the stars of those movies, Roy Rogers and Gene Autry and Hopalong Cassidy, those were some of the best known names, but also less well-known stars, Rod Cameron, Wild Bill Elliott, Tim Holt, and especially Lash LaRue. As I grew older, my tastes became somewhat more sophisticated simply because I saw better movies. And even as a kid, I was able to determine that Randolph Scott movies were better than Gene Autry movies. But it didn't matter whether the movies were the low-budget B variety, those simplistic tales of white-hatted good guys and black-hatted bad guys, or the more nuanced films directed by John Ford or Howard Hawks, the heroes shared certain traits. They were frequently loners, men who didn't live in towns or belong to any stable human community. They lived by a code, and that code was usually unwritten, but no less rigid for that. And even though these characters were featured in what were often called cowboy movies, they seldom did the work of cowhands. They were gunfighters or lawmen or simply lone riders, their occupation unrevealed. They were sort of like knight errants of the West, and their work usually meant ridding a town or region of any element threatening the establishment of a so-called civilized society and making it safe for women and children. And then once their work was done, which inevitably involved violence of one kind or another, they rode or walked away. So they made communities possible, but they seldom lived in them. These were mythic male figures, larger than life, characters more likely to be found in legend than in reality. And then the 1960s came along, and then the Western films were as often engaged in myth-breaking as myth-making. And so instead of the quick-draw demigods who were unbeatable in any conflict, whether with Indians or outlaws, rustlers, or the cattle barons who were looking to push out the small ranchers, think Shane, the movies gave us anti-heroes, psychologically conflicted characters who were often created to demonstrate that the myths of the Old West were false. Think Jack Crabb in Little Big Man. But even before the movies decided to separate fact from legend, I knew something wasn't quite right about the way cowboys were depicted in popular culture, whether movies or television. And how did I know? It was really very simple. My grandfather looked nothing like John Wayne or Randolph Scott or Hopalong Cassidy, and my grandfather had been a cowboy. Gustavus Adolphus Peterson, that was my grandfather, didn't ride out of nowhere. He came to America on a ship. He emigrated from Sweden and found work in the Western Dakotas and Montana, where he was known as Bronco Gus, a horseman of some repute. And though he came to this country and became a cowboy, an iconic American figure, and how laughable he would have found both that phrase and that concept, he didn't count himself a success until he put his cowboy days behind him, filed a homestead claim, married, raised a family, and helped establish a community. I suppose in the parlance of TV and movies of the day, he was probably a sodbuster. But he had none of the cattleman's scorn for farming. And when he wasn't doing the hard work of running the farm, he played the mandolin, guitar, and accordion. He stayed up all night once a week drinking coffee, reading newspapers from Sweden. He wrote an autobiography, and we have a copy of it. It's a single page, rendered in very, very elegant handwriting, consists primarily of dates and place names. But he wrote, and these are his words, "Those pioneer times were rough and rugged, and you had to be strong and tough to take it." But of course, his toughness had nothing to do with fist fights or saloon shootouts and everything to do with making sure that his family was provided for. And that also meant that the family had a church to attend and his children a school, which they found their way to during blizzards by following his fence line. For practical reasons, he kept horses on the farm. And he lost one of his sons when the boy was trampled under the hooves of a team of horses. That very same year, they lost another son, their two oldest children, to pneumonia. And after those two deaths, my grandfather said he never saw my grandmother cry again. My grandfather wore a perpetual frown, but it didn't have anything to do with his disposition. He had been kicked in the head, and that crease was the result of that. He was a kind, cheerful man who would never ever have claimed any similarity between himself and a character in a movie. And I'll stop talking about him now because I'm going to be doing some mythologizing of my own. But I'll just say this one more thing. His descendants both resemble and refute the cowboy stereotype. His grandchild and great-grandchild reside in Montana. They have their own ranches. They've both competed in rodeos, and both of them are women. So Kelvin Seide, the main character in As Good As Gone, also has a realistic sense of who and what a cowboy is. He's lived that life. He knows there's nothing romantic about it. In fact, he mocks the myths that cling to such figures. Yet he does have a code he lives by, and in its general outline, it bears more than a passing resemblance to the code of those movie cowboys. In practice, however, his self-reliance looks like mere stubbornness. His chivalry is sexist. His independence is of a variety so extreme he has difficulty fitting into human society. His distrust of authority comes out in vigilanteism. When he returns to his hometown to look after his grandchildren, he stays in the basement of his son's house, and that was a detail that gave me a working title that lasted through a couple drafts of the novel. I called the novel Cowboy in the Basement because I believe the romantic archetype of the cowboy lives just below the main floor of our cultural consciousness. We don't believe in him, not exactly, but that doesn't mean we let go completely of the longing for the myth to become reality and for one of those Western knights to ride to the rescue. But we've all heard the caution, of course, we should be careful what we wish for.
That's Larry Watson's essay, I See by Your Outfit, Cowboys Real and Imagined, written for Algonquin Books, the publisher of his novel As Good as Gone, a finalist for the 2017 High Plains Book Award. In a bit, we'll hear him talk about his writing process on New Letters on the Air. But first, here's Larry Watson again to read from his 10th book.
As Good as Gone is a novel that takes place in the summer of 1963, and it begins on the 4th of July. And in the first chapter, you'll meet two of the main characters in the novel, Bill Seide and his father, Calvin. Bill Seide has traveled out to his father's place. His father's living a sort of reclusive life out on the prairie, and Bill wants to ask a favor of him. So it's July 4th, 1963, East Central Montana. He's watching, Bill Seide thinks. My father is watching me at this very moment. But Bill can't take his eyes off the road, a steep, twisting, two-track trail that winds down from the top of the butte to the canyon floor. A juniper bush scratches the side of the car, and Bill winces. Something that sounds more solid than weeds scrapes along the undercarriage, but there's nothing Bill can do other than keep the tires in the ruts and feather the brakes to make sure he doesn't lose control on his descent. And sure enough, when the road finally levels off and Bill permits himself a look farther ahead, he sees the figure that he's sure has been there all along. A tall, lean, white-haired man stands in the open doorway of a 20-foot house trailer, his hands jammed in the pockets of his faded Levi's. Calvin Seide, Bill's father, a hawk with prey in sight, could not watch more intently. Bill parks and climbs out of the car, and when he slams the door behind him, it sets up an echo that bounces from one canyon wall to the other. He lives here, Bill thinks, so he can see the enemy approach. It's the same thought he's had on the other occasions when he's driven out to his father's home. But this time, Bill wonders if even he has that status in his father's eyes. His father calls out warily, I didn't know you were coming. To that, Bill has no response. His father doesn't have a telephone. He picks up his mail no more than once or twice a week. How can anyone, son or stranger, notify Calvin Seide of an impending visit? His father tries again. What brings you out this way? And that's Calvin Seide in a sentence. Let's get to it. Well, that suits Bill, too. I've got a favor to ask. His father steps back inside the trailer, but since he doesn't shut and lock the door behind him, Bill understands that he's supposed to follow. The trailer is exactly as Bill remembers it, and why not? It's likely that nothing more than the calendar page has changed since Bill was last here, though he can't recall when that might have been. His father has his life stripped down to the essentials, and for everything that's left, he has a hook, shelf, bin, drawer, peg, or rack. And there's that calendar, hanging right next to the door. It's this year's, and the pages turn to the correct month, but Bill wonders if his father knows the date. Even if he does, the day surely doesn't mean holiday to him, the way it does for most Americans, though it's hard to imagine a man who values independence more than Calvin Seide. Bill stands by the small kitchen table. From a pitcher on the counter, Calvin Seide pours water into a glass, then sets the glass on the table next to an open book. Bill brings the glass to his lips and drinks. The water isn't very cold, and it has a brassy odor. His father crosses his arms. You said you had a favor to ask. Bill is sweating in these close quarters and he loosens his tie and collar. Marjorie has to have a hysterectomy. It's an operation to, I know what a hysterectomy is. What I don't know is why you felt you had to come out here and tell me about it in person. How serious is this? She has not tumors exactly, but growths, painful growths. All right, his father says, I'm sorry to hear this, but you drove all the way out here. What's the favor you need? There's a doctor in Missoula who will perform the operation, Bill says. Carol, you remember Marjorie's sister, had the same condition as Marjorie. Same symptoms, same tests. Apparently it's something that runs in the family. And Carol had the surgery. Most women would just bite down hard and wait for the misery to pass, which it will. Most women? In my experience. Something of an expert, are you, Dad? His father ignores the question. Marjorie has to go to Missoula? Look, Bill says, I can't pretend to explain it very well. Apparently, the Missoula doctor has a special procedure. The point is, Marjorie wants the operation. She needs the operation. And I reckon you're all set for her to have what she needs. We're leaving in a few days. Uh-huh. Bill inhales deeply and then exhales, but the heat seems to prevent his breath from traveling far. That's what I wanted to ask you about, Dad. Would you be willing to stay with the kids while Marjorie and I are in Missoula? What I'm asking you for, says Bill, wouldn't be more than a week at most. You're traveling in a few days, you say? He's trying to find a way to say no, Bill thinks. He's out of practice and he can't find a reason quick enough. Why doesn't he come right out and say it? They're not my kids or my responsibility. He could say it when the children were his own, so what's stopping him now? Anne and Will, says Bill, in case you're trying to recall their names, Anne's 17 and Will's 11. I know my grandchildren's names. Anne's working at JCPenney this summer, Bill continues. That's why I'm asking you for this favor. Ordinarily, Anne could take care of her brother and take care of the house, but with the hours she's working, Will would be alone too much of the day. From out of his shirt pocket, his father takes a packet of cigarette papers, and when he looks around for his tin of Sir Walter Raleigh, Bill hurries to offer his father one of his own Camels. The men light their cigarettes, and while this action has given his father an extra minute to think, it's less time than he would have had rolling his own. We could hire a babysitter, Bill says, a college girl home for the summer, perhaps, though that might embarrass Anne, someone there so close to her age. Or maybe we could find a farm girl. But you know the house, Dad, and the business, and your... Bill isn't sure why he suddenly stopped short of uttering the word, especially since it's the word that he came here to say to his father. I'm what? Family, says Bill, relieved that the word didn't snag on the way out. His father draws deep on the Camel, lets the smoke drift from his nostrils, then examines the cigarette as if he's never smoked a tailor-made before. When did you say you're leaving, he says? Sunday, right after church. And Dad, I'm not asking you to do anything with the kids, just to be there, just in case. His father walks to the trailer door, opens it, and flicks the cigarette outside. I'll be there Saturday, he says. His father remains in the doorway, his hand on the handle of the screen door, just as Bill understood earlier that he was supposed to follow his father inside the trailer. Now he understands that he's expected to leave. I'll look for you then, Bill says. He steps out into the shadowless sunlight, and though the air is not moving outside the trailer any more than it was inside, it's the rare calm day in this part of Montana. Bill feels as though his first breath outdoors goes right to the bottom of his lungs.
Larry Watson, reading from As Good As Gone, here on New Letters on the Air. Watson's 10th novel continues with Calvin Seide going to Gladstone, Montana, to take care of his grandchildren. So we get to meet the 17-year-old Anne, who's being stalked by an ex-boyfriend, and 11-year-old Will, who's suffering from bullying. Of course, Calvin takes care of things in his own way. Here's novelist Larry Watson to talk about As Good As Gone, now out in paperback.
One reviewer said, you probably couldn't have a worse babysitter for your children, but he means well. I thought this book was just going to take off And then somebody published a review with a warning in it. And the review was generally pretty complimentary, but it said, warning, this book contains sex scenes involving the over 60s. And I could just feel sales stopping dead in their tracks. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the ideas that went into the writing of the book. I never know how a novel is going to end when I begin it, so I am making it up as I go along. I have some things figured out when I begin. I have characters, main characters certainly. I have setting, both time and place. A situation, a premise, a conflict, a problem. I have something like style, but not exactly style. Something probably closer to voice. Something that seems to say, tell it this way. And then some technical things are involved in that as well. Something about point of view, although I've gotten that wrong in the past and had to revise and do something with point of view. That happened with this book. In an early draft, it just didn't work. And the reason it didn't work, I believe, is that Calvin Seide was not a point of view character. So he was only seen from the outside. We didn't have any of his thoughts or feelings on the page, any of his perceptions. So that tension and that difference between a mythic figure in some ways, and he has that status not only because of his cowboy past, I couldn't get that tension without having his point of view. And then I have a first sentence. I don't start writing a novel until I have the first sentence. It feels to me as though if I find the right first sentence, that the rest of the novel is just sort of waiting behind there. And it's not exactly true, but it kind of is. It's something that gives me some momentum. I feel as though that first sentence has some energy that propels me a ways into the story. And then I'm making it up as I go along. I have a story to tell, and I just try to tell it as best I can. For me, that means sentences. You know, I'm concerned about writing sentences and finding the right words in those sentences. The business about how many drafts we do and how much rewriting and revising, I think, can be awfully tricky. It doesn't seem to me that I get a sentence right the first time through very often. And so is that first draft, fifth draft? And also, I like to clean up as I go along, and I like to get it right before I move on. Because my hope is always that I won't have to revise. I'm not a good reviser. I don't like to do it. I need help with it. And so I think, okay, if I just take my time, get it right, it'll be fine. Never works out that way. But when I begin a novel, I figure I need to make a commitment of at least 2 years, although I've certainly abandoned novels in much less time than that. I've also abandoned novels that took longer than that, but I think, yeah, I've got to allow for some time. When I was in school, we didn't write. I mean, one of the many ways that education is better today than when I was in school is that students write. For me, it was grammar one semester, and grammar usually meant diagramming sentences, and I was never good at that. And literature the next semester, and it seemed like it was Silas Marner every single semester. So I didn't write until I was in college. But when I started writing in college, particularly when I started writing poems, it just felt good right away. The poems were terrible, but it didn't matter. I mean, I wasn't trying to write terrible poems. I was trying to write good poems. But it felt good to make something, and it connected with something in childhood, and it connected with the kind of making that I did sometimes as a child, painting or drawing or carving something, and probably pretend play as well. So I think I had some of those writerly impulses before I knew what they were or what to do with them. I don't think a lot about theme. I know, or at least I hope, that my novels have themes. I guess I would think about those things in another way, maybe something having to do with meaning or significance. I don't feel as though I have to know what the themes are. I just need to feel that this story has some weight. And maybe I will discover it in the act of writing. I don't want to know too much about theme because I don't want my fiction to be predetermined to seem as if it's simply working out a theme. I want the theme, the significance, to emerge from the characters and the events, something that is at the heart of good writing. I think it's details. For example, when I have Anne walking up that street on the 4th of July, I'm thinking about a street in my hometown. I'm not going to have all of the details exactly the same, but I'm going to use some of them because I feel as though they're going to help make that scene vivid and believable. So I write a lot from memory, and I just trust that the things that stick in my memory are sticking there for a reason. I don't have to know what that reason is, but that I can use those things in my fiction. I also had a grandfather who was a sheriff, and as someone noted in a bookstore recently, so you had a grandfather who was a sheriff and a grandfather who was a cowboy. I said, yeah, I did. It was my wife who noted that. She knew it very well, but suddenly it just struck her. And so I have lots of books with sheriffs in them. You know, I think what it is that I feel as though I can write about a sheriff or a cowboy and do it believably because I've known someone who was a sheriff and someone who was a cowboy. My father was also a sheriff. And as a writer, I'm always looking for some point of entry, and that's enough. And is that inspiration? Maybe. I would also like to say something about inspiration that I think I do believe in, and that I think inspiration can occur in the writing itself. So, for example, I might come up with a metaphor or a couple of metaphors having to do maybe with flight or light and shadow or something. And I think when that happens, our work is trying to tell us something. And maybe it's trying to tell us what it's about or trying to tell us what the theme is or tell us a direction to take. And so I try to keep my antennae up when I'm writing and watch for ways that the writing might be telling me something. Thanks for being here tonight.
Larry Watson at Mid-Continent Public Library's Woodmeath Center in 2016 after the release of his novel As Good As Gone, longlisted for the 2017 Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction. It was also a finalist for the High Plains Book Award, which he won for his previous ninth novel, Let Him Go. The film rights for that have been optioned. In the meantime, Watson has finished his next novel, also set in the High Plains, but this time with a female protagonist, due out in 2019. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. To subscribe to the magazine or listen to previous shows, visit our website, newletters.org. Our free weekly podcast is on iTunes and Stitcher, and you can follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter. Today's show was produced with Nick Shea, Mackenzie Callahan, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.